On Sunday, January 19th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature trombonist, conch shell player, and composer Steve Turay. Join us as we discuss his career, trombone legend J.J. Johnson, and 30 years of playing with the Saturday Night Live Band. That's Sunday, January 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And you're listening to Nina Simone in the background. I went with Sugar in My Bowl from the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl 1967, 1972. It was originally recorded in 1967. And this is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Steve Turay is our guest this evening, and we're going to start off the program with a selection from his latest release, The Bones of Art. Daylight is the name of this song, and it has Steve Turay, Robin Eubanks, Kaumba, Frank Lacey on trombone, Steve Davis on trombone, Xavier Davis on Fender Rhodes piano on some, Peter Washington on bass, Willie Jones III on drums, Pedro Martinez on percussion, and this is a 2013 High Note release. Stay tuned for Sugar in My Bowl.
In my bowl. Thank you.
My name's Joyce Jones, and I am here with
Steve Touré.
Hi, Steve Touré. Thank you so much for letting me join you in your space here at Juilliard.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And now, as I was saying before we were recording, I thought that you were born in New York. And come to find out, you were born in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah, that's right. I was born there, but I don't remember a thing about it because I was just born there when my father was going to school at Creighton University, you see. And they moved back to California before I was even a year old. I grew up in the Bay Area in Oakland. Like, you know, most of the musicians in New York are from somewhere else. If you take 10 New York jazz musicians, 9 of them are from somewhere else.
So how was music in California for you? How was it growing up?
It was pretty fertile. You know, the Bay Area is actually, for creative music and for jazz and whatnot, is much hipper than Los Angeles. Los Angeles' primary focus is Hollywood. You know, it's about that scene. You know, it's not about jazz or creative music or black music or Afro-Cuban music or whatever you have. It's more about Hollywood and who's got the latest car and who got perfect teeth and dyes hair blonde and, you know, who's making the most money and all that. That's a different scene. You know, New York, I like it more, but I got to tell you, for artistic things, you know, New York, for America, New York is the jazz capital of the world, really. But the Bay Area was very hip. Though it was like had a little sliver of New York in it, and all the bands used to come there. You know, I saw Miles and Cannonball and everybody. You know, shoot, I wasn't old enough to see Coltrane because you had to be 21 to get in clubs. So I miss Coltrane, but you know, so many, all the greats.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're generally known for playing trombone and then conch shells. Mm-hmm. But I understood with Chico Hamilton you played electric bass. So how'd you wind up toward musical instruments in general?
Well, I started playing bass in high school because there was a band and one a bass player. We played funk and rock and stuff, and we do some James Brown tunes, some Beatles tunes, whatever was popular, and we'd work the dances for that local high schools. You know, when I was in high school, and I'd get my money to go to movies and whatnot that way, just a little chump change, you know, but it was starting to work. So, you know, there wasn't any jobs for trombone at that age, but I could get work playing music. So I started playing electric bass. And then later in college, I started playing acoustic bass and went through getting the blood blisters and all that stuff. But I was with Chico originally playing trombone. And he called me up in a panic and said, you know, we got the gig this weekend. I said, yeah, I know. He said, well, my bass player just left, and it was Wednesday night. And he said, you know any bass players? I called everybody I know, and everyone's busy. And I said, well, let me see. And I got on the phone, and all the cats I knew that played, they were busy. So I said, well, Chico, I play bass. I got a bass in the closet, and I already know the tunes because I'm playing trombone in the band. I'll cover until you get a bass player. So I played, and after the first night, he told me, he said, well, I'll give you a raise. I want you to stay on bass. So he damn near doubled my salary.
Wow.
And I stayed on bass for 2 years with him. But after 2 years of playing bass, I really wanted to play my trombone. So I ended up leaving the band because I wanted to play trombone. You know, but I did 2 records with him playing bass.
Thank you.
I played trombone on a couple of tunes, you know, but my heart was with the trombone. But I gotta tell you, I really learned a lot by playing bass and being part of the rhythm section. Because, you know, with a horn, a lot of horn players have a tendency to just float on top of the rhythm section or follow the rhythm section. But by me spending some meaningful time in a rhythm section, a working band, and see, when I first joined, Alex Foster was playing alto, then Arnie Lawrence came in, and then Arthur Blythe, Black Arthur, came in. And that was really something. When Arthur was there, Rodney Jones played guitar, and Abdullah was playing congas, and I played bass, and Chico on the drums. That was it. And Arthur just had such a great sound. Wow. And he played fabulous. And Chico loved him. And the music took on a new direction when Arthur came in the band. And by being part of a rhythm section, I transfer that to my horn. So when I play the trombone now, I play like I'm part of the rhythm section, not just on top of the rhythm section floating, but I'm in there playing the rhythm with my horn just like I would on the bass. So it really helped my concept to grow in a big way, and it was a fabulous experience.
Now, was Chico your first professional gig?
Oh, no. I actually started in junior high playing in a band with my older brother. And we played standards, and he played sax and clarinet, and we played standards and New Orleans traditional music.
What's your brother's name?
My older brother's Michael Touré. He lives in Los Angeles, and he plays jazz and Latin bands out there and stuff. And my younger brother, who's 10 years younger than me, he played drums with Ray Charles for 18 years.
And what's his name?
Peter Touré, up until Ray passed. And my daughter was the last Ray let to sing with Ray. She was the last to get hired.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then in college, I did a lot of gigs and everything. And that's when I first played with Rahsaan Roland Kirk. So I think Rahsaan was my first meaningful jazz gig. And then I went on the road for a year with Ray Charles.
Tell me about your time with Rahsaan. How was it playing with him?
Well, it's incredible. Rahsaan was like a walking history book, but authentic. He wasn't just playing other people's licks. He knew the styles from New Orleans and from Ellington and from Charlie Parker, from Coltrane and from Freedom. He knew all the stuff. And he played and still be himself, you see. And it was like going to school and getting paid for it. It was fabulous. I first played with Rahsaan my first year of college, and we became friends. So whenever he'd come through town, he'd call me. And I'd work the local club with him. He'd give me $50 for the week or something. I didn't care. I was a kid. I just wanted to play. And I played later on with him up until he passed. Once I came to New York, I joined his band.
My goodness. Yes, you are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Got Matchmeet in here messing around because Ian Forrest is late. And this is no good. Messing up sugar in my bowl. All right, so what we're listening to right now is actually Dorthan's Walk from Rahsaan Roland Kirk. He's referring to Mrs. Rahsaan Roland Kirk, Dorthan's Walk. And this is from Boogie Woogie String Along. Oh, there's Steve. Oh, okay. So Steve Turay is on trombone here. Rahsaan Roland Kirk on tenor saxophone, and he's also the producer. This was his Rahsaan Roland Kirk's last release. Eddie Preston on trumpet. Kenneth Harris on flute. William S. Fisher on electric piano and regular piano. On regular piano, we have Sammy Price. Jimmy Buffington on French horn. Charles Fambro, Eugene Moy, Jonathan Abramovitz, excuse me, on cello. Julian Barber, Linda Lawrence, and Selwert Clark on viola. And let's see, we have... Doreen Callender, Harold Kwon, there's a whole string section of violin folk. Philip Bowler on bass, Sonny Brown on drums. This is 1974 release, no, 77 release. And before that, we heard Ray's Collard Greens, Where the Interruption Occurred. Ian Forrest, get your act together. Ian Forrest is the host of Connections that happens around 3 a.m. Yes, I'm giving him just a plug, but you got to get your stuff together because it affects other programs, okay? Okay. Now, Ray's Collard Greens is from In the Spur of the Moment by Steve Turay. Steve Turay is on trombone and shells. Ray Charles, the Ray in question, on piano. Peter Washington on bass. Peter Turay, Steve's brother, on drums. That's a 2000 Telarc Records release. Hooch, before that. The name of the record was Hooch, with Steve Turay on bass. Chico Hamilton on congas and drums. Peregrinations was the name of the release. Arthur Blythe on horn and multiple reeds. Will Connell on alto sax and Rodney Jones on guitar. A 1976 Blue Note Records release. And before that, we heard The Morning Side of Love by Chico Hamilton. Wait a minute. No. Hooch is from Chico Hamilton and, oh, goodness, and his band or something like that. And his, that's the wrong title. I have to correct that. And The Morning Side of Love is the song we heard before that. There's Chico Hamilton from Peregrinations. Chico Hamilton on drums. Steve Turay playing bass. Abdullah on congas, bongos, and percussion. Arnie Lawrence on alto saxophone. Arthur Blythe on horn, multiple reeds. Barry Finnerty. And Joe Beck on guitar. Jerry Peters on keyboards, and that was a Blue Note 1975 release. Let's go back to the Exchange while I find the right name of that title for the album. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl, Joyce Jones. Stay tuned.
After that experience, I went on the road with Ray for a year. When I came back from Ray's tour, I met Woody Shaw, and we became dear friends. And he introduced me to Art Blakey. I sat in with Art Blakey at Woody's encouragement, and Art asked me to join the band and brought me to New York. And we worked our way across the country. We played at La Casa in St. Louis and then at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago. And then we opened at the Village Gate in New York. And I stayed at Art's apartment for about 2 or 3 weeks until I found my own place to live. And he was good to me. then after art, I joined Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra for about 6 or 8 months. And then some of the regulars, I took a couple of people's place that had been sick. And then when they got their health back together, that's when I went with Chico. And after Chico, I went and rejoined Rahsaan.
So the time before when you met Woody Shaw, did you play with him or?
Yeah.
I mean, you recorded a lot with him. I was trying to get those dates right.
Yeah, but I sat in with Woody, you know, early on. Then we were in the Jazz Messengers together. And then when he came here, I did his first record in New York on the Muse label.
Thank you. Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for January 19th. In this segment, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's guest, Steve Turay, appears on Tuesday the 21st in a J.J. Johnson 90th birthday tribute at the New York Baha'i Center's Weekly Jazz Night. The Baha'i Center's at 53 East 11th Street. For details, you can call 212-222-5169. That's 212-222-5169, or do a search for them on the web. Blueswoman Alexis P. Suter is at the Iridium tomorrow. That's Monday the 20th. See theiridium.com for tickets and information. Also on Monday the 20th, pianist Mark Carey appears with the Namaskar Ensemble. See Cornelia Street Cafe, all one word, .com for details. Organist Akiko Tsuruga has a regular Monday night gig at Manhattan's Kotobuki restaurant. She'll be there on the 20th and 27th. She has gigs this week at Londell's on the 24th and Showman's on the 25th. See her website at akikotsuruga.com for details on all those shows. And I'll give that one more time. That's akikotsuruga.com. Akiko Tsuruga. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on Wednesday the 22nd to promote his new Right on Time release. See smallsjazzclub.com for info on that show. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts leads the Watts Family Reunion Band at the Jazz Standard from the 22nd to the 25th. See jazzstandard.net for details. Pianist Vijay Iyer leads a trio at Jazz at Lincoln Center on the 24th and 25th. See jalc.org for details on those shows. Harpist Brandy Younger's quartet performs a free show at the Flushing Branch of the Queen's Library at 1:30 p.m. on January 25th. See queenslibrary.org and look for the events tab for details on that. Looking further ahead, saxophonist Kenny Garrett appears at the Celebration of Jazz Saxophones at Rutgers University, Newark's Paul Robeson Campus Center on Tuesday the 28th. See newark.rutgers.edu and click on the events tab. Looking even further ahead, Amiri Baraka's memorial tribute is scheduled for February 8th at 7:30 p.m. at the Schomburg. Save the date, and we'll give you more details for that coming up. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2, WBAI.org, or you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We're off next week for the last Sunday of the month, but we'll see you February 2nd on the Bandstand.
Just to let you know that the information with regard to the Amiri Baraka Memorial Tribute happening at the Schomburg.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI. New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
Just wanted to let you know that the tribute to Amiri Baraka, the memorial tribute, the information is up on the Schomburg site. Just go to Google and put Schomburg in the search engine, and you will see that Randy Weston and Quincy Troop and several other folks will be participating in the February 8th tribute, memorial tribute to Amamu Amiri Baraka. And also to let you know that what you're listening to right now, what I am speaking over, is a Woody Shaw recording titled Katrina Ballerina. It's from The Moon Train, the first release on Muse Records. Woody Shaw on trumpet, Steve Turay trombone, solo I'm speaking over. Azar Lawrence on tenor saxophone, soprano saxophone, Onaji Allen Gomes on piano, electric piano on others, Cecil McBee, whose solo I'm speaking over now, on bass, Victor Lewis on drums, Tony Waters on congas, and before that we heard Fantasy in D from Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, and then again, Art Blakey on drums, Steve Turay on trombone, Woody Shaw on trumpet, Carter Jefferson, tenor saxophone, soprano saxophone on others, Cedar Walton on piano, electric piano, Mickey Bass on bass, Tony Waters on congas, and that's a 1973 Prestige Records release. And before that was Dorothy Ann's Walk. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and Steve Turay coming up now. Oh, and by the way, the playlist is up on the Sugar in My Bowl website, sugarinmybowl.org.
Started all of that. I've done over 15 records with Woody. Probably more than that now that I haven't gotten paid for it, that are coming out bootlegs. You know, these clubs would be recording the sets without telling you, and then when the artist passes on, they release the records. You know that. So,
how old were you? I mean, it's like you seem to have done all of this before you were 20.
No, not that young. But I did all that before I was 25. Yeah, well, I think I was 25, probably when I was with Chico.
I don't think we actually talked about your time with Woody Shaw, what that was like for you. And I know you recorded a lot, but how was it having him as a band leader?
It's an incredible inspiration. We toured a lot. The band was really working, and working more than bands do today, because it was a time when bands could do six nights a week and tour the whole country for a month. And that's how you really develop, by playing every night. And it was during the time with Woody that I found my own voice. And he was really instrumental in encouraging that to happen, because, you know, he encouraged me to try things. But, of course, don't be bullshitting just to be different, but reach for things, you know. You know, one night I remember I played something and I felt like I got lost, but got back. You know, I felt like I was struggling. And so when I finished playing and Mulgrew Miller was playing his piano solo, Woody come over and he whispered in my ear, he said, "Remember that stuff you played coming out the bridge on your second chorus?" And I said, "What?" You know, and he had photographic memory. So he sang my solo to me.
Wow.
Mm. And I said, "Oh yeah, that mess, man. I remember that, man. I was trying to get out of that, you know." He said, "Yeah, but I like the way you got out of that. I've never heard anybody do that on the trombone before. Those kind of intervals you were playing." He said, "Keep doing it." I said, "I don't care if you take a chance. Just resolve it. Land on your feet. You know, make sure you're still with the tour, so to speak. You know, you're part of the music. Don't just go off and be off. You go off and try and set a direction. That's cool. Then resolve it." And so through his encouragement, because, you know, when you first start reaching for things, you know, you're not sure if it's cool or not. You want the approval of your peers, of course, and you hope the audience likes it too. But, you know, any serious artist is their own worst critic. And, you know, you want to know that people enjoy what you're doing. And, you know, I tried some stuff and he would encourage me to say, "Yeah, that's cool. I like that." You know, so it really helped me to have that seeking spirit. Rahsaan was like that too. He had a seeking spirit, you know, and I really liked that approach.
As a band leader, Do you have new folk? Well, you don't seem to have new people in your band. Am I wrong in that observation, or?
I got a pool of people that I use, and then from time to time I use different people. It just depends. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, I'm not going to just try somebody because they won the poll or because they're popular or something. I'm looking for a certain feeling. And if somebody gives me the feeling that I want, great, come on.
How do you find people? How have you found newer people?
By listening to them and by playing with them. And if it clicks, it clicks. And if it don't, I've had instances where I play with something and there's something about them I like, but I just didn't think they was quite ready yet. And then a year later, I met them and played again, and they grown a lot, and it was time, and then I'll call them, you know. But I like to use younger musicians, but they got to be able to swing. You know, I don't care how many notes you can play or how high you can play or how different you are. I want to know that you can swing, number one, and that you can play the blues. Because, this is a big problem for me now. You're getting me started, but the blues is the foundation of our music. And when they start calling music that doesn't have nothing to do with African rhythm, African concept of improv and call and response, and the blues, then to me, it's more like improvised European music rather than jazz, which is really coming out of African American culture. And if I didn't know better, if I was just stretching it, I might say there's actually a conspiracy to destroy the music but then again, not, because when you look at things historically, the critics have always been wrong. They said Louis Armstrong was not happening. They said Duke was playing jungle music. They said Coltrane was anti-jazz. You know, Bird was playing fragments, and then history proved them wrong.
And Miles was selling out.
Yeah, all of that. You know, everybody has their opinion. That's just what it boils down to. But, you know, I tell you something that's very interesting in regards to this phenomenon. You know, I've won the Downbeat poll numerous times. I think my manager told me he called up the magazine 26 times, including the readers and the critics. And I think the only person who wanted more on my instrument was J.J. Johnson, who was our Charlie Parker, you know, for the trombone. I remember one time I was doing a feature article for them, and they said, "But it's the 10th time you won a poll. How does it feel?" And I said, "Oh, it's a great honor. I really appreciate it." And, you know, it's great to know that the readers appreciate what I'm doing, and any artist likes to feel appreciated. And I said, let's face it. They buy your magazine. They support the music. They buy our records as artists. They come to the clubs and concerts and support our performances. So the fact that they are aware of what I'm doing, appreciate it, that's great. I said, but I got an interesting proposition for you, because your business is selling magazines and you do jazz and that's all good and everything. But I said, we have the readers' poll. And they have a right to express who they appreciate, because they buy the magazine, they buy the music. They support you and me. I said, we got the critics poll, and they're doing their job. And I just left it at that, being diplomatic. Because historically, they've almost always been wrong.
Right.
And then I said, why don't we have a third poll? Well, what's that? I said, why don't we have a musician's poll? We're the ones creating this music. Who do we feel is innovating and contributing and leading the way? You know, and how would you know who to choose? I said, that's easy. That's no problem. I said, you could say anybody that's placed in the poll in the last 10 years, plus acknowledged masters that don't need to be in a poll and haven't polled because they don't have a publicist and a manager and all that. Like who? I said, like, for instance, Barry Harris or Milt Hinton, when he was here at the time. Milt Hinton, he's a master. You know, he doesn't need to be in a poll. Or Doc Cheatham, he had seen it all. Or Slide Hampton, you know, it's easy. I really encourage you to do this, because I guarantee you'll sell a whole lot of magazines. The readers would love to hear who we, as the artists creating this music, who do we think is really doing it? I said, it's not hard to get that together in a meaningful way. And you know, when the article came out, they edited that completely out of my interview. They didn't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
See, that's the problem with, you know, I was talking to M2ME, actually, James M2ME, about the jazz documentary, the Ken Burns Jazz.
Don't get me started.
and how, you know, they didn't talk to the musicians. You know, they talked to certain musicians, but they didn't talk to the ones who were there at that time.
Absolutely. It was misinformation. I mean, there was a lot of good stuff in it, but there was some serious misinformation. The fact that they didn't even mention J.J. Johnson's name was abomination. And it wasn't just J.J. You know, there was a lot of other people that was major contributors that were just almost seemingly deliberately omitted. But, you know, Ken Burns is not the end all.
No, but musicians ought to have a voice. Yeah, it's like, it's almost as though, okay, you can play, but you can't speak.
Yeah, because, you see, forgetting that we're in America, and America is based on capitalism and not free enterprise, but capitalism is based on exploitation. And even though we're creating something that's part of our lives and an expression of life, as far as the business community is concerned, we're a product. So, no, we don't get to speak. We're supposed to just go play and smile, you know. Thank you.
what was your relationship to Kimathi Dinizulu?
Oh, Kimathi, man, he's my man, man. I miss him so much, man. What a spirit. Well, you know, we met when I put together the Sanctified Shells, the show choir group, for lack of a better word. It's a large ensemble. It's not a big band. It's hardly like a traditional big band, but it is like 13 people. And I had this idea, and I wanted an African drummer that also understood the syntax of jazz. And I was recommended Kimathi, and I met up with him, and it was like we had known each other all our lives. I mean, it was instant communication, and I brought some shells over, and the two of us just played, and I realized that there's a real deep connection between the shell and the hand drum, because the hand drum is made from wood and animal skin. It was alive once. The shell is made from the house of an animal. It was alive once, too. And the vibrations, really something about they complement each other in a very meaningful way. I love the trombone, but it's made out of metal. It's manufactured. You know, the shell, you can just pick up something from the sea and clean it and open the end up, and it's an instrument already. You know, it's natural. And I don't know, there was just a real connection there, you know. Yeah.
Which leads me to your playing shells. When did you start doing that?
1970, I got my first shell. And interestingly enough, it was because of Rahsaan. One time Rahsaan came through San Francisco, played at the Both Ann Club on Divisadero Street. And he had a shell. And he put it down there by his chair where he kept all his saxophones and everything. And he had three horns and a flute and a clarinet and all that. And after three nights, he hadn't played it. And I said to him, I said, well, Rahsaan, are you going to play that? What's it for? He said, I'll play when the time is right. You know, so I said, okay, you know. And he also had this gong. And one night, you know, when you're playing in a club, it's open to the public. You never know who's going to come in there. Sometimes crazy people come in there, you know. One night, I mean, and Rahsaan would play the joint, be packed. And one night there was this couple sitting right in the very front table, right in front of the bandstand, got drunk, and they's oblivious to the music, and they was talking loud, having their conversation, and the woman's telling the man, but I told you to take out the garbage. And the guy said, well, I did. And she said, no, you didn't. And man, you know, and Rahsaan had wanted to play a ballad, and they were oblivious, so he picked up the shell, and he blew this note that he held for a long time. And, you know, that whole publicity stunt with Kenny G about circular breathing, the longest note and all that, that's just what it was, a publicity stunt, because Rahsaan was the champ of circular breathing.
Oh, yeah.
He was the champ. And he held this note. Ooh. Time, man. And after about 5 minutes, these people finally realized something was going on, and they stopped talking, and they looked up in awe, you know. And when they stopped talking, everybody clapped, you know, yeah, you know. And then so Rahsaan, while he's holding this note with one hand and he's circular breathing, keeping the note going, sustaining it, he takes the gong and he doesn't just whack it. He feathers it. He hits it lightly a bunch of times quickly, and it starts to shimmer like, you know how they shimmer. And just when it crescendoed and the gong really crescendoed into this beautiful sound, he put the shell down and put the tenor sax in his mouth, and he started to play this ballad like real soft and pretty, like Ben Webster. You know, and, oh man, he had the audience in the palms, and you could hear a pin drop. You know, it was so beautiful, and the sound of the shell kind of set the whole thing up. It made the room hold still. There's something peaceful in the sound of the shell. It really made people stop and just be calm, you know. And I really was attracted to that. I really liked it. So after the set, I asked him, could I try that? And he let me blow the shell. I said, oh, man, I'm getting one. So I went and got one. That was 1970.
Where'd you get the shell?
My mother brought it to me from Hawaii. It's a conch. Or some people say conch, and some people say carrucho, and some people say caracol, and some people they say, oh, there's a million names for them, you know, different languages. But I like to learn the name of the shell in different languages.
How did you find other people to want to join you in playing shells?
Well, it's just meeting people and, you know, mainly trombone players. And I talked to guys that said, man, I got this project I want to put together. Would you be interested? You know, and they say, some say yes, some say no. I say, I don't want to play the shell. I just want to play my horn. I say, okay, cool. Some guys would say yeah, and then I'd let them try to play a shell. And if they seemed to have a natural affinity for it, I'd take it a step further. But if they just started struggling with it right from the top, I let it alone because I don't let people take the shells home.
Oh, they play your shells.
I make the instruments myself. There's certain notes that the shells are in, like keys, you know, and I write the music to fit the sounds of those shells. I'm not letting anybody take the shells home because if they lose one or break it or something, I have to rewrite all the music or try and find another shell at that pitch. That's tall order. So they just have to play them at rehearsal. But if you can play the trombone, the shell isn't all that different, the concept, because when you move your slide to change the pitch, you put your hand in and out of the shell to change the pitch. It's kind of similar in a way. We'll be right back.
Lester Bowie.
Brass Fantasy. That was a charming man. And we had a lot of fun. I learned a lot from Lester, too, about colors and sounds and taking chances. But we used to have fun just being silly, too, man. It's amazing what audiences would go for when you put the right theater with it. You know, I used to goof around at rehearsal and make this sound with my horn, playing my horn while I'm sticking out my tongue.
Oh.
And everybody would laugh, you know. And so one night we were in Germany, and you know in Germany they like some out stuff, man, out. So he come over to me, someone's playing a solo, and he come over to me and he say, listen, after this tune, I don't know what to play next, so I want you to just play a solo until I call another tune in the band, get the music up. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, just play anything. Remember that stuff you was doing in rehearsal? I said, yeah. I said, he said, do that. I said, come on, man. He said, no, go do that. Watch what happens. And I went and did that stuff, and the people, man, I got standing ovation. Man, I couldn't believe it. And then afterwards, we in the dressing room laughing and say, those silly, those people don't know, man. You know, it's unbelievable, man. But then, you know, that's just having fun with it. But then he could really play, too. He had a beautiful tone quality. Even though he's known for making colors and sounds and unorthodox stuff, when he wanted to, he had a gorgeous tone. Just a beautiful trumpet sound, full and rich and warm. And I did a lot of writing, too. I got a chance to write for that band an awful lot. So I got a lot of wonderful experience writing, composing, and arranging as well.
You know, Randy Weston says that trombone is like a voice of, it's just the human voice, pretty much.
Yeah, I agree with that, especially, you know, people always think the tenor saxophone sound like the human voice. Absolutely not. It sounds like a tenor saxophone. The trombone, especially Tricky Sam with Ellington with the Pixie and the Plunger, that sounds more like someone talking than any saxophone ever will. Absolutely. But, you know, there's so many colors and so many different tone qualities and sounds that you can get out of a trombone, because one of the things is, whereas the saxophone, you just press the keys and you can blow and change notes. And the trumpet, you just press the valves and blow and you can get your notes to change. With the trombone, we not only have to move the slide, but we have to coordinate our tongue with every note with the slide, or else it sounds like everything is glissandos, you know. And so to play it clean is extremely hard. But because everybody's tongue and mouth is different, everybody's approach to articulation is very different. And it's interesting in that no two trombone players sound alike. It's also an observation, too. J.J. Johnson set the bar so high because he played as clean as any trumpet or saxophone player. And it's so hard to play on that level that now guys are starting to take it backwards and playing on a lesser level and calling it the new thing when it's actually been done before, you know. But when it was done before, it was because the music hadn't evolved. But if you're truly taking the music forward, you got to stand on the shoulders of those that came before us and then take it further. You can't just disregard what happened before, you know. So how are you going to take it to the next thing when you ain't even got what it is yet? So it's an interesting observation about a lot of what's happening now. But here again, that goes to capitalism.
Is there anybody now that you see coming along that may be learning trombone?
Oh, there's a good bit of them. I mean, but I'm older. So you talking about in their 20s or like young?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few, sure.
Anyone we should keep our ear out for? Are they working or are they still learning?
No, they're working. They're working. But I don't feel that I need to mention names.
How are we supposed to know that they're around?
Listen.
Okay, fine.
Well, of course, you know J.J. Johnson. He went on to do TV and movie scores.
Yeah, he was a fat. You know, J.J. was just as heavy as a composer and arranger as he was as a trombonist.
Do you know how he got the opportunity to do that?
What, to write?
Yeah, to write scores.
He had always been a great writer in the jazz community, and Dizzy had asked him to do Perceptions and a poem for brass for some of his large ensembles that was more than just a regular big band. You know, it had French horn and woodwinds, all kind of stuff. And then he did a whole series of big band records for RCA that used more than, it was a standard big band plus, you know, had a lot of woodwind doubles and stuff, bass clarinet and flutes and stuff. And you could hear the colors that he had were very visual even back then. And he also knew Oliver Nelson and Tom McIntosh and Benny Goldson and some other people who were writing for the movies. It was very hard for brothers to get into the movie scene in Hollywood in those days, especially, but he, interestingly enough, they would throw him some bones and he wrote the music for Cleopatra Jones.
Right.
And Blaxploitation.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's cool, you know. Yeah. And Shaft, he did Shaft. And
he worked on Shaft?
Yeah. He did the music for the original Shaft when Isaac Hayes sang it. I think they gave Isaac Hayes credit, but J.J. did all the scoring.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Interesting.
And remember he did this TV show, Buck Rogers?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
One in the 80s.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's done a lot of other things, too, you know, but those are some of the more popular things, you know. And he's just an incredible arranger, composer, you know. Everything makes sense. Mm. You know, it almost seemed like some people, not some people, it's, I got it, and we'll get back to the critics. It's like, if they don't understand something, mm-hmm. then it must be heavy because I don't understand it. Well, yeah, but have you ever thought of the possibly maybe you don't understand it because there ain't nothing to understand? But that doesn't ever occur to them because it's really, if you present something with enough theater, they'll go for it. But to me, music, first and foremost, is an art that is, deals with the creation of sound. And the sound should come first. I want to hear some beauty. I want to hear something that's going to heal me. I don't want to hear someone's frustration or someone's intellectualizing like a robot reading a dictionary. I want to hear some emotion and some healing energy. The life force comes through the sound. The sound energy carries vibration. Vibration can heal you. This is the kind of music I'm attracted to. It's not what's being marketed today, but that's what I'm attracted to.
Now, on the subject of television, you're part of the SNL, the Saturday Night Live house band.
Yeah, for 30 years.
How did you get the call for that? What happened?
I auditioned, and I got the call.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I went and auditioned with Earl Gardner, and we're still there after 30 years.
Earl Gardner plays?
Trumpet. He's the lead trumpet player. When we played together, I played lead trombone, he played lead trumpet with McCoy's big band, too.
Oh, okay. Now, the Saturday Night Live house band, do they have an official name? Because I know they've had a couple of names.
No, the official name is the Saturday Night Live Band.
Oh, okay. There was this guy, G.E.
Oh, G.E. Smith. Yeah, well, they always put whoever's the leader at the time, they say G.E. Smith and a Saturday Night Live Band.
Oh, okay.
Right now it's Lenny Pickett and a Saturday Night Live Band. Oh, okay. But I tell you, the band right now, it's all good musicians. We're playing for television, and it's cool and everything. And it definitely helps make ends meet. It's a lot of fun. I mean, where else can you go to a gig and when you're not playing, you're just laughing because everything is crazy, you know? And comedy, people acting crazy and stuff, and it's fun.
Do they still have that rule that live performers have to play live?
Well, they used to.
Yeah.
But they've changed in recent years because too many big-name pop stars have come there and completely flopped because they had to play live instead of lip syncing.
Right.
And everybody find out they cannot sing.
Right.
Or they sing horrible out of tune. And if they have to do it just for real, they can't.
Right.
So ever since that Ashley Simpson debacle,
yes.
They've allowed lip syncing. You know, so now Rihanna lip syncs.
Wow.
All of them. You know, they're not. If you go to a concert, you're going to see them, but you're not going to really hear them. You're going to hear the record. They're
right.
just pumping the record through the speakers, and they're up there pantomiming, and it's a dance routine, look like an aerobics class.
Right.
But there's one person that could not only really dance, but could actually sing and dance at the same time, and that was Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
He was the real deal.
Well, Tina Turner could do it, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, that's old school. Now you got to get auto-tune, and you lip-sync, and you just concentrate on going to the gym every day. You don't practice singing. You go to the gym and everything but the music. I can't remember the name of the band, but it was one of them indie bands. It was one of them bands like Green Day or Smashing Pumpkins, but it wasn't them, but it was one of them kind of bands. One time they were on the show, and they had a whole entourage with them. They had a hit record at the time, and they went on and did their song, and when they came off, all their friends were there. They say, "Oh, yeah, man, you're great, you sounded great." And the lead singer says, "Sounded great? How do we look?"
Oh, no.
You know, MTV, they sell them videos. Right. It's the video. It's what it looked like. It's imagery. It's not what the real sound is. I got a gut feeling, and I hope it's not true, but I think it probably would be, that if Aretha came along today, she might not make it, because they're not looking for that. They're looking for someone that's kind of fair skin and's got a sexy body and just know how to shake the booty. They're not looking for somebody that can really sing.
Right.
I mean, look what happened with Jennifer Hudson. I mean, she's one of my favorite singers out there, the younger set today. She can really sing, really. Put tears in my eyes. You know, after Whitney, I think she's one of the greatest singers that we've got in that genre.
Right.
In the lineage, the tradition. But when she was on Star Search, she was, you know, she wasn't thin and all that. I didn't think she looked bad. She looked beautiful to me, but
right.
they're looking for a certain look. And so she didn't win, but she was head and shoulders above everybody else, man, you know.
But even now, she has bought into the physicality.
She wants to work.
Exactly.
And since she's lost that weight, she's getting a little more attention, but she still ain't working like some of them other ones that can't touch her.
Right.
It's just capitalism.
Yeah. So on the subject of capitalism, record labels.
We have to laugh, a collective laugh from all the artists in the world. Well, it don't matter whether it's pop or jazz or whatever, it's just a collective laugh, you know, because the bottom line is we're a product and they're just selling us, and we're like meat on a supermarket shelf, and they talk about it, and not in front of us, but to each other. They go, "Oh, well, this one sold so many years," or "I got this one for so much money, how much did you have to pay him?" Whatever.
So do you have a home presently?
I just finished a run with High Note Records. I've done 6 albums for them. So at the moment, I'm freelance. I don't know whether I'm going to start my own record company. I got 3 records that I could put out right away. Or I would kind of like to do both. But right now, I don't really have the funds to start my own label and do it right. See, I'd like to do it right. You know, you can put out a record and put it on iTunes. And, you know, man, I mean, I know that that's where it's going. And people don't like physical. A lot of younger set doesn't have physical CDs as much anymore. But to really have a record be successful, today's world, as much as it's about the sound, it's about the promotion and the packaging. And that's money. But I would like to have my own record so that when I go on the gigs, I can sell my records. And then I can still do a record for a label. It's funny, when I was with Verve Records, which at the time, for the longest time, Columbia was the big record label for jazz. I mean, Miles was on Columbia and, you know, everybody. And that was it. And then they quit doing jazz. And then Verve in the 90s, Verve was the thing. And I was with Verve during that period.
Right.
And when I was with Verve, I worked every major festival, Montreal, Monterey, Chicago, Detroit, in Europe, all the festivals in Europe, Poirier, and Umbria, and you name it, all of them, you know. And then once I wasn't with Verve anymore, it's like they didn't even know my name. My agent would call up, "Steve who?" I said, "Well, he's just there last year." They said, oh, yeah, not this year.
Wow.
You know, but then I remember the manager I had at the time. I was with Verve, and Verve had just signed Liz Wright, but a record hadn't come out yet, and they wanted him to manage her, but he didn't want to. They told him, "Well, we already got a European tour for her." Now, usually they tell you, "Well, you want to go on tour, but you don't have a record. Where's your record? What are we going to push it with?" But she didn't even have a record out yet, and she had a European tour because she was with Verve. You see, so in other words, the record company is really the one that's greasing the pot, and that's the big ones. But then after the 90s, with the digital thing coming in, the record companies weren't able to pull their usual super greed trick. It was just like humane profits. So all of a sudden they quit supporting a lot of the artists like they were during the 90s and before. They weren't interested in building careers. You know, they do anything just so we can get a certain number in sales, because that way the A&R man and the producer and the VP, they get bonuses. And then they can go buy that boat or second house or whatever they want and get that money. The artists don't get none of them. You know, the artists create the music that they sell, and it's the last one to get paid.
Right. There are a couple of labels that may be, like High Note and Mac Avenue and Motema.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that there may be places that are worth going to checking out.
Well, the reason I like those labels is because they have musical integrity.
Right.
They are true to the music.
What are you doing? Are you doing anything around town? What's happening?
I'm doing all kind of different things. I know in January... the 21st, I'm a guest soloist with the Band of Bones at the Baha'i Center for J.J. Johnson's birthday tribute. Then in February, something that I'm really looking forward to, February 7th, at a theater, I forget the name of the theater because I've never been there before, but there's a theater in Rahway, New Jersey, and I'm doing a big program, an event that's a tribute to J.J. Johnson. It's being archived for the Smithsonian, and it's a series that they're having there called Masters on Masters, and I was asked to do JJ, and I said I'd be honored, you know, as much as I've learned from him. And, you know, JJ played on one of my records. Yeah, so that would be, if you were a saxophone player, like having Charlie Parker play on your record.
Yeah.
And even though we were good friends, we used to talk on the phone all the time. Standing next to him, having him play standing next to me, I was in utter awe. Man, this man's sound is just so off the hook, man. It's impeccable, you know. A true artist of the highest order, you know, and a giant. Perfect gentleman, too. What a respect. He carries himself with so much dignity, you know, and I can't say enough. I'm more than happy to try and do my best with his music. The guy presenting the series got a grant, so it's educational, too, so I got to do something with kids. So I'm going to do one song with a junior high band that we're playing at JJ. It's all JJ's compositions. One song with a high school band playing. Another one is tunes. Then I'm going to do something with a quartet, something with a quintet with trombone and tenor, another thing with trombone and trumpet quintet, then a sextet with trombone, trumpet, and tenor. And then we ended off with the big band, because he gave me some of his actual charts that he recorded that featured a trombone, El Camino Real, Save When, and Little Dave. And I'm going to perform those with the big band. And Rufus Reed, who played with JJ, is playing bass. Victor Lewis and Xavier Davis are in the rhythm section. Wallace Roney's playing trumpet, and Javon Jackson's playing. So in a way, too, the front line, we were all jazz messengers. So there's a lot of history there, too, you know. And, of course, everybody loved JJ, you know.
And that's February 7th?
Yeah.
In Rahway, New Jersey?
Yes.
Oh, tell me about Juilliard. What are you doing here? How'd you wind up here at Juilliard?
I teach trombone. Jazz trombone specifically. There's a very good orchestral school here, you know. It was originally orchestral school. And so they have a fabulous orchestral trombone teacher, Joe Alessi, who plays principal with the Philharmonic. And we're good friends, but I do the jazz. You know, I enjoy it. The students here are on a very high level. I got to think of something else to say, because I know I spend a lot of time at times talking about where the music business is taking the music. I don't live for that. I live for the positive. And for instance, I like Saturday night after the show, I went to Dizzy's, to the after hours, just to relax, because I've been hearing the rock, the guest band and all that all night, and it's pretty loud. And I just wanted to hear something that was swinging and something to relax and before I went home. So I went by and I heard a young sax. I don't remember his name, but I heard a young brother playing a sax up there, reminding me of Arthur Blythe. Man, he could play. He had a beautiful sound, man. You know, and it's so, I know that there's some young people up there that are listening. And it's just really gratifying to know that the music is going to live on no matter what the business says. or are they going to try and change the definition of it? It already is what it is, and it ain't going nowhere, because the truth is the truth.
Well, thank you so much, Steve Turay, for having me in your space here at Juilliard, sharing this room with you.
My pleasure.
And that was my conversation with Steve Turay. I visited him at Juilliard in December, and got around to playing it now. Let's see, what we're listening to right now is Steve's Blues from the Verve release Steve Turay. That was released in 1997. It has Steve Turay on mute solo, J.J. Johnson on open solo. That's him, J.J. Johnson. John Faddis on trumpet, Robin Eubanks, Kuumba Frank Lacey, Jimmy Bush on trombone and shells, Reynaldo Jorge on conch. Robin Eubanks and Steve Turay are also playing conch. Stephen Scott on piano, Douglas Perviance on bass trombone, Andy Gonzalez on bass, Milton Cardona on congas. Yeah, listen to that. Yeah. Okay, let me be quick. Victor Lewis on drums. And before that, we heard Coming Back to Jamaica. And somebody named Ian Forrest needs to come here from Jamaica so we can do a show in the studio or something like that. Anyway, Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy, I Only Have Eyes for You is the name of the release. Lester Bowie, Bruce Purse, Malachi Thomas, and Stanton Davis on trumpet. Steve Turay on trombone, Bob Stewart on tuba, Bob Stewart who was at the Winter Jazz Festival with Howard Johnson's Gravity, Joe Daly and all the cool people. Gravity, must see. They have something coming out this year on Motema Records from what I hear. Soon, I hope. Let's see. We have Stanton Davis on flugelhorn, Vincent Chansey on French horn, Philip Wilson on drums. That's a 1985 ECM Records release. Before that, we heard Exploration from Steve Turay's Sanctified Shells, Andy Gonzalez on bass, Kamati Dinizulu, the late Kamati Dinizulu on bass drum, Steve Turay on bells, Milton Cardona on claves, Reynaldo Jorge, Robin Eubanks, Steve Turay on conch shells, Milton Cardona on congas, Kamati Dinizulu on bass, djembe, sorry. Herlin Riley on drums, Reynaldo Jorge on maracas, Kamati Dinizulu and Milton Cardona on percussion, Steve Turay on percussion, Lama Hooves, Kamati Dinizulu on percussion, Sankofa Akenye, Steve Turay on shaker, and Milton Cardona on shakare. That's a 1993 Antilles Records release. And before that we heard Katrina Ballerina, as I mentioned, from The Moon Train, and that's a 1995 Muse Records release. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa and the rest of Steve's Blues. We'll be back on February 2nd with more. Oh, and by the way, the performance that Steve Turay had referenced, February 7th, the J.J. Johnson tribute, is at the Union County Performing Arts Center in Rahway, New Jersey. It's a Friday, February 7th at 8 p.m. You can go to www.ucpac.org. That's ucpac.org. It's a Masters on Masters event. Steve Turay honoring J.J. Johnson. And the Union County Performing Arts Center is... And it's the Hamilton stage that is at 360 Hamilton Street. You could also call 732-499-0441. That's 732-499-0441. And we'll be mentioning it again, but I just wanted to clarify as it was mentioned in the exchange. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar Mabel, Joyce Jones, I shall be back with the bandstand on February 2nd.
Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.